dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the great resources that this program is privileged to make available to all of you each week is David Goldman. He is a master of the universe in the financial sector by profession, but he is a Renaissance man with great accomplishments and skills in everything from punditry and column writing to, well, advanced musicology. He is, in short, an author and a tremendous friend of mine, and I'm always appreciative of his time. And David, I want to say, first of all, welcome. And the timing is particularly good because as we speak, the House of Representatives is considering whether to formally, at last, launch an official investigation into the basis for impeaching Donald Trump. They've been at this for some time, pretending they had an official basis for doing so, but presumably this party line vote, more or less, will give them that that pretext now. You have written a very important, I think, and quite persuasive piece, to my way of thinking, in PJ Media recently, entitled, "It's Time for Every American Patriot to Rally Around Trump. The American Republic is at stake." Tell us why that's so.
We're in a constitutional crisis, Frank. If a cabal of disgruntled, disaffected intelligence community personnel can combine to sandbag a president and effectively treat the will of the American people like toilet paper, overturn a presidential election, then our freedoms mean absolutely nothing. If they can railroad the president of the United States, they can do to me or you absolutely anything they want. And anyone who looks at this honestly, even a liberal Democrat like Alan Dershowitz, has said it is complete nonsense that the Ukraine issue is grounds for removal of the president from office. Whether there was a quid pro quo or not, it's irrelevant. The issue is whether the will of the people prevails over that of a cabal of spooks. And we now know that a certain Eric Caramella, who worked for Vice President Biden, was a protege of the communist voting liberal former head of CIA, John Brennan. This Caramella was the whistleblower, and that the Central Intelligence Agency tore up its own rules to allow him to blow whistle about something he had no direct knowledge of and invented a story, the purpose of which is to railroad the president. So whether or not you happen to agree with most of Donald Trump's policies, and I do, but even if you don't, we have to stop this railroading because although if we have a coup in the United States, which is effectively what it is, the Constitution's a dead letter. So it's a watershed moment in our history.
Let me ask you about this whistleblower. We know this, as you say, at the moment, I believe, principally because a man for whom I have great professional regard, as I do for you, David Goldman, Paul Sperry, has written about this chap, Eric Caramella, in Real Clear Investigations and lays out the fairly abundant evidence that ties this individual to the so-called whistleblower, whistleblower number one, some say, because there's supposed to be a second one, but it seems as though he may have done much to inform that second one. But the point is that I think that what we have now, what's been brooded in Washington circles for quite some time, is someone whose own credentials, whose own character, whose own political agenda can be finally assessed as one starts trying to make sense of the charges that have set in train what I really think of as kind of the coup 4.0, because there have been a series of these now, as you know, each of which in previous instances has failed. But David Goldman, you mentioned John Brennan. And John Brennan, as the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, was clearly deeply engaged in previous phases of this coup. Remind us what we know of him. You mentioned some of his past sort of predilections, but why is this so troublesome that somebody running the Central Intelligence Agency would have been engaged in such activities, to say nothing of having his particular characteristics?
We know that the CIA and FBI solicited information from foreign powers. This is the point of the Steele report, in order to sandbag Trump even before he won the election.
Specifically, to put a fine point on it, Russian sources among them.
Precisely. Steele was financed by the Hillary Clinton campaign through a cutout, through a law firm. He then went to Russia, talked to his Russian friends, got a bunch of Russian disinformation, turned that into the famous Steele dossier, which the Federal Bureau of Investigation, meanwhile, took to a foreign intelligence surveillance agency court in order to get the authority to bug the Trump campaign so they could set them up further. So here we have facts that are not in dispute, which is prima facie evidence of collusion with foreign powers in order to intervene in domestic politics. Trump tried to fight this. Can't rely on the FBI, which is riddled with political opponents and people who were acting illegally to sandbag him, whom Attorney General Barr is now beginning to investigate on a criminal basis. He's forced to use direct access to foreign governments to help get to the bottom of how this collusion was staged against him. That is effectively the point of the discussion with Ukraine. So whatever Trump was doing with Ukraine, whether there was a quid pro quo about defense spending, I don't care. In my view, Trump was simply defending the national security of the United States by attempting to scotch this nefarious effort by elements of the intelligence services to wreck the result of a presidential election. And on top of that, we know that Mike Flynn was sandbagged by the FBI. His attorney has brilliantly assembled a dossier which shows that the FBI ambushed Flynn in an interview, which was designed to prove that he lied to the FBI when he did no such thing, and that the 302 form, the report on the interview by the FBI agents, was altered in order to put entirely innocent statements by a great American patriot, General Flynn, into a criminal light. Now, if they can do that to the president's national security advisor, to a distinguished three-star general who served his country his whole career and railroad him that way, if they can topple the president, your and my liberty means nothing.
Yeah. Well, this is why, as you say in your PJ Media piece, David Goldman, the republic itself is at stake for all of us, as well as for, you know, our posterity, as the founders would say, our children and our children's children. And this is why what's happening on Capitol Hill, even as we speak, is really such a travesty. David Goldman, thank you for your insights, as well as always, your courageous clarity in addressing them with us. Come back to us soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is truly an honor, as well as a great pleasure, to welcome to our microphones once again a friend and colleague of many years, a national treasure, really, who has suffered some health setbacks in recent months and is now back on his feet and back in action. And I couldn't be more pleased at that fact and the fact that it's, among other things, possible once again to visit with him. He is Robert Spencer, the author of 19 books, including a new one that will be coming out on the 3rd of December. I suspect that that can be pre-ordered now at Amazon. It's entitled The Palestinian Delusion, the catastrophic history of the Middle East peace process. How exciting. It's something I look forward to visiting with you at length about, Robert. But in the meantime, there's a lot of other things to talk about. Let's, first of all, welcome you back aboard. It's so good to have you, and congratulations on recovering your health. I'm so gratified.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's great to talk to you again.
Well, let's talk a little bit about somebody who's not in such good health at the moment, thank God, and that is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the late spiritual leader and driving force behind the Islamic State. We, of course, note but do not mourn his passing. Robert, what do you think it means that he's been taken out for ISIS, but also for the world?
Well, it's a great victory for the forces of freedom. There's no doubt about that, Frank. The Islamic State has suffered tremendous reversals in Iraq and Syria. As we know, they've lost their territorial caliphate, but they're still going on. They're quite an active jihad terror organization. And now this is a major blow to their fortunes and their morale. But we shouldn't overstate it at the same time. This has never been a movement based on the power of a charismatic personality, and it isn't now, and they will go on.
And what moves them, I think, is what we really need to be addressing, Robert Spencer. And you've studied it so closely, you've written so lucidly about it, you have spoken so courageously concerning this ideology. I've come to call it Sharia supremacism. Others have different terms for it. But describe the importance of that doctrine, that ideology, to not only what ISIS is about, but what so many other groups with whom it sometimes makes common cause, with sometimes it is at war with. But what about this, and why is it important to have our eye firmly on that rather than narrowly on, you know, who's leading which group at any given moment?
Well, Frank, this is the thing that all the terror groups, all the jihad terror groups in the world have in common, and that is the imperative to impose Sharia, Islamic law, on every government, on every state, every country, everywhere in the world. Now, obviously, they're not going to ever succeed in doing this, but will they commit a great deal of murder and mayhem in their quest to do so? There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And while our government still is largely committed to the idea that Islamic terrorism doesn't really have anything to do with Islam proper, Islam as such, in reality, this is the unifying link behind every jihad terror group and the ultimate goal behind every act of Islamic terror, that the idea is to destabilize non-Muslim governments and also Muslim governments that don't follow Sharia, and ultimately bring about their collapse and replace them with Sharia governments.
I should have mentioned right at the outset that you are the director of Jihad Watch, an indispensable online resource associated with the David Horowitz Freedom Center now for many years. And you have, again, through your myriad books on various aspects of this problem, shed very clarifying light on the doctrine, the ideology, the unifying theme. Tell us a bit about something that you've recently written up, which is the successor, we're told, to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, a fellow by the name of Abdullah Kardash. What do we know about him, Robert? And is there any indication that he is other than a full-on Sharia supremacist too?
Frank, there's just the opposite, as a matter of fact. Abdullah Kardash is a Sharia judge. And so this is somebody who has dedicated his life to understanding and applying Islamic law properly. And he is going to continue in the same vein as al-Baghdadi, who himself had a PhD in Islamic studies. The other salient thing that we know at this point about Kardash is that he actually was at one point, also like al-Baghdadi, imprisoned by American forces and let go. And so it's a very vexed question. It's a very difficult problem as to what to do with these guys. But we see it again and again, that prisoners at Guantanamo and prisoners of allied forces elsewhere, once freed, they go back to the jihad.
Yeah, because they believe that is Allah's direction to them. It is divinely ordered that they engage in it. And as you were saying a moment ago, Robert Spencer, they may not accomplish their worldwide dominion, but it won't be for want of trying, that's for sure. And one of the things that I really wanted to visit with you, because your perspective is global with respect to this agenda and its adherence. There is evidence, it seems to me, now pretty compelling evidence, Robert, that whatever comes of the Islamic State's fortunes in the Middle East, it is on the march elsewhere around the world. There is a ministerial meeting, as you surely know, coming up on the 14th of November, sponsored by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which I think some 30 countries are going to be summoned to talk about both the problem of ISIS in the Middle East and globally. One of the areas that I'm particularly concerned about, and I just wondered if you have focused much on it of late, and that is Nigeria and the region surrounding it known as the Lake Chad region. Of course, the Islamic State is only one of the jihadist entities operating in that area now. The Fulani militants, as they're known, Boko Haram, of course, are others. But as you were saying a moment ago, Robert, they all have the same agenda. They may have different ideas about who will rule under this caliphate. But talk us through what the implications are should the caliphate simply set up shop in Africa's most populous nation, with its immense natural resources, and how that might actually make things considerably worse than the caliphate of old in the Middle East.
Yeah, they're making a concerted effort to do this, Frank. And what we see is a split in Boko Haram, where one faction has actually allied with the Islamic State and now calls itself the Islamic State in West Africa. And they want to set up another territorial caliphate to replace the one in Iraq and Syria. They're also working on doing this in the Philippines. Now, the thing about this is, in Nigeria, the government for years has said Boko Haram will be a thing of the past by the end of the year. Boko Haram has essentially defeated things like this. And yet Boko Haram just keeps going, both factions, the independent faction and the Islamic State faction. And if the Islamic State succeeds in establishing a new foothold there, then they're going to be able to thumb their noses at the Nigerian government and the surrounding nations as well, even more so than they do now. They're going to carry out attacks with greater impunity because they will be able to draw on the international resources of ISIS, which still exist. The governments of Cameroon and other countries in that area have already suffered attacks from the Islamic State in West Africa, the Boko Haram faction of ISIS, and they will continue. That's likely to step up.
Let me turn to a related topic, and that is we're being told that the Turks are on our side in the struggle against ISIS, that we can rely on them specifically in Syria to help suppress the Islamic State following the withdrawal of most American forces from that country. I'm interested both in what you make of Turkey's role today in the region, Robert Spencer, but also very quickly, if you could, what Turkey is up to with respect to something else. I think you were the one who coined the term stealth jihad. The Muslim Brotherhood and its operations in places like, well, the United States of America, for example.
Well, the thing about stealth jihad is that it is a nonviolent method of, or nonviolent variety of methods, I should say, to achieve the same goal as the violent jihadis have, and that is to impose Sharia. In the United States, we see it with the establishment of mosques in particular that are teaching that no government has any legitimacy unless it establishes Sharia, teaching that Muslims should not necessarily commit violent terror attacks now, but should bide their time until such time as it is opportune to try to gain political power, whether by violent means or peaceful. And also efforts to infiltrate the U.S. government with people who will tamp down on efforts to counter terrorism and to counter the spread of Sharia. We've seen all of these. I detailed them in my book, Stealth Jihad, back in 2008. And we see Turkey now taking up the slack. The Saudis were for many years the biggest backers of these initiatives financially and in other ways. And now the Saudis have cut back on their efforts to do this, and the Turks have filled the gap. And they are building mosques all over the country. Most people just assume that a mosque is like a church or a synagogue, and they teach peace and brotherhood. And that may be true in many cases, but unfortunately, it is abundantly documented. There have been four separate and independent surveys conducted since 1999 that all showed that 80% of mosques in the United States were teaching supremacism, hatred of Jews and Christians, and the necessity ultimately to replace the U.S. Constitution with Islamic law. This is now largely a Turkish initiative in the United States.
Robert Spencer, your insights into all of these problems are simply indispensable. Stay well, my friend, and come back to us very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Seth Cropsey. He served with great distinction in a number of senior positions in the United States government, notably as the Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. He was also the former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict. He is the author of a number of very important books, including Mayday and, more recently, Sea Blindness, How Political Neglect is Choking American Sea Power and What to Do About It, the topic we wish to discuss with him as we speak. Seth Cropsey, welcome back. It is so good to have you. You, of course, are these days with the Hudson Institute, which just had the Secretary of State speaking to its big dinner up in New York last night and making some news with a very robust speech about the threat from communist China. And that, of course, is an important backdrop to the case for American naval power, arguably the need for naval supremacy and the challenge that we're now facing from it, from China, and to some extent, even from Russia at the moment. Give us sort of a sense of how you see the dangers we're facing at sea and from the sea, for that matter.
Well, it's good to be with you again, Frank. If there is a conflict in the West Pacific, which is to say between the United States and China, the chances are excellent that it will be a naval conflict. The Chinese are claiming the South China Sea, which we say is international waters and which the law of the sea says is international waters. And so China has disputes with all its with all the countries in the region. Its attempt to deny us access to the Asian mainland up to 1,000 miles puts at risk our communications with allies like Japan and South Korea. At the same time, China's Navy is increasing by leaps and bounds in every category of weapons, as were on display, many of them, in the 70th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party's founding at the beginning of this month. So we face a growing challenge from China in that part of the world. And at the same time, Russia is emerging as, if not a peer competitor, then as a near peer competitor. And so we're seeing things that we had not seen since the Cold War, which is to say U.S. Navy patrols in the North Atlantic as a result of increased Russian ship activity. That, of course, goes and it goes without saying, because we have limited time, that we have an issue also with Iran in the Arabian Gulf and in the Eastern Mediterranean with the Russians and the problems that are taking place in Syria.
So we have global challenges, and a lot of them need an American naval response. And so far as, 70% of the world is covered with water, and a lot of the threats are now emerging from those waters, over as well as under them, as needless to say, as well as on the surface. At the same time, Seth Cropsey, you have been arguing for a larger fleet, as have I. It's clearly needed. The Navy has been throttling back of some fairly ambitious, but perhaps still not adequate, force levels to contend with these sorts of challenges. What can you tell us about the current state of our naval power to meet these challenges and the plans for enhancing it?
Well, our current state is not bad. There are several things that could be done to improve matters, but I don't think that today is the day that the Chinese Navy would like to engage the U.S. Navy anywhere in the world, not even in its own waters. What concerns me is the trend, and the trend does not go in our favor. It goes against us, because as the Navy indicates that it may be scaling back on its desired goal of a 355-ship fleet within 30 years, the Chinese are building at an impressive rate. The Russians tested an ICBM this week, fired from below the surface in one of their new Bory-class SSBNs. So I'm not so much concerned about today, Thursday, as I am about 5 and 10 years from now.
Mm. Well, let me probe you about this. I hope what you say is so. And yet, just as one data point, and I don't want to read too much into this, but it seems to me it's a pretty ominous sign of the readiness of our fleet, as well as its power projection at the moment, is that every single one of the six nuclear-powered aircraft carriers in our Atlantic fleet is, as I understand it, tied up in Norfolk, our major port, in some state of repair or maintenance that precludes it from being available for sea service. Is that not an ominous sign, Seth Cropsey? And if it's not, why not?
I wouldn't call it ominous. It's not unprecedented. It is unusual, but there are problems in what you described.
But could I just ask, the pregnant question is, if it's not unusual or unprecedented, isn't it unsatisfactory?
It's not good. Yeah, no, I agree. That's not an issue. Three of those carriers are in for extensive overhaul. That takes at least a couple of years, usually a little bit more than that, to complete. So that's not fortuitous. One of the carriers, the newest one, the Gerald Ford, has had problems for a long time, and that is a source of concern. It should be both to national leadership and certainly it is to the Navy.
These are technical problems with the, is it the catapults or what is the cause of the problem?
There are repairs that are needed to the propulsion plant and also to the weapons elevators, which are electromagnetically operated. And things haven't gone as well as everybody hoped they would go. And so, for example, it began sea trials, the Ford did, a year after it was supposed to, as a result of repairs.
Still underway. And the Truman is also suffering problems. Let me, without getting into all the details on that, Seth, just because we're going to run out of time, this is happening at the same moment that we are seeing the numbers of ships that the Navy aspires to have being cut back from 355, I think, as the goal to something on the order of 315. Is that right? And does that not suggest that we're likely, as you say, perhaps in the next decade or so, or perhaps sooner, to really find ourselves facing significant shortfalls in the kind of presence and power projection that we require, given the threats that are emerging?
And that's why I say I'm more concerned about the foreseeable future than I am about today. I think that Americans have this general and misplaced idea that we are in a lot better position navally than we in fact are. That misperception could be the cause of, you know, multiplying problems in the future. We're not as strong as we need to be facing the future.
Let me ask you about the architecture of the Navy itself quickly, if I could, Seth Krupsey. Again, you've given a lot of thought to this, at least in your most recent book, Sea Blindness, when you talk about what we need to do about the Navy. Are big deck carriers still as important to today's missions as they have been in the past? And if so, are we addressing properly the importance of having them available, given what you've said about, well, on the one hand, the readiness of the fleet, and on the other, the difficulties in modernizing it?
I think the big deck carriers are here for a while, and that the question is not at the core whether big deck carriers are sufficient for current and foreseeable needs. I think the question at the core is, what is the composition of the air wing on those carriers? And the Navy is making tentative steps to change the composition of the air wing from manned aircraft to what are called unmanned aircraft, drones, if you will. And the best place that the place to look, but the example of that is in the tanking, refueling, where the Navy is relying on, it will rely more and more on unmanned aircraft to do tanking. But the problem is that the manned aircraft that we have, both the ones on the decks now and the ones that we'll see in the foreseeable future in the F-35, do not have the range to stay outside the strike envelope of China's anti-access.
Which is one of the reasons, of course, why we're seeing people argue about whether the aircraft carriers are viable. I take your point that more range in what's on their decks makes a lot of sense. But the question, I guess, is, are we still investing in an asset that is a diminishing value in the kind of environment we're currently in and will be in the future? But that's a topic for further discussion with you, Seth, I hope in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you for the work you're currently doing at the Hudson Institute. Come back to us soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say we are joined by Joel Gilbert. He is a man who has fearlessly addressed in a number of films and books subjects that are sometimes quite controversial and sometimes downright outrageous, but he does it with panache and usually some very formidable research. And I have learned much over the years from him, perhaps not agreeing with everything, but nonetheless have always found it interesting. And I think that is almost certainly going to be the case for you as well in the topic of today's program. He has most recently done a very interesting film and book combination entitled The Trayvon Hoax, Unmasking the Witness Fraud That Divided America. We wanted to get him on to visit a little bit about it. I do have to say, though, we've caught up with Joel Gilbert, having been forced to relocate from his home in the general area of Simi Valley and the Reagan Library, which is at the moment under some threat from wildfire. The power is out there, and we catch up with you on the run, I guess. Joel, it's good to catch you. And I mentioned to you before we got on air that I've done my commentary today about some of the insights that this extraordinary event in Northern and Southern California, resulting in PG&E turning off the power to folks like yourself, is causing. It's a real wake-up call, it seems to me, for all of us in this country.
Yeah, it's been a little crazy 24 hours just watching the flames from my house go up around the Reagan Library, which I was pretty confident they had under control. But just the amount of smoke and the way the wildfires spread so quickly, you can just in a blink of an eye, these embers can float in the air and something can catch on fire. So it was pretty harrowing, but I'm in West L.A., so happy to be on the phone with you.
Good. Well, as am I, you. And I did want to just draw you out on kind of the distilled essence of this story. We don't have time to do justice to all aspects of it, of course, but I've been very concerned, as you obviously have been as well, by the sort of now conventional wisdom that America is a country filled with hatred and racism, imbued by the founders, but much in evidence at the moment. I don't buy that personally, but one of the moments in which that story really, talk about embers catching fire, took off is this case of Trayvon Martin back in 2013. Tell us about what you have found about that case that is very different from what we've been told to this point.
Well, many things. And the quote, by the way, from Mao Zedong was, "A single spark can start a prairie fire." And prairie fire is also the name that the Weather Underground, Bill Ayers, gave to his Communist Manifesto to overthrow the United States. And this is the concept upon which the Obama administration used Trayvon Martin's death and the Trayvon Martin case to divide the country along racial lines for political purposes. And people may not know this, but Judicial Watch, for example, pulled some documents that showed that the Department of Justice sent the CRS, Community Relations Service, down to Sanford, Florida to investigate this case, and instead they actually helped to organize protests. So it was all part of this game to use black voters to keep political power. The black vote was not in the tank for Obama in 2012. Everything had gotten worse, 50% unemployment, illegals coming in, taking jobs, taxes going up. So they just jumped on this case and sent in Al Sharpton, the Department of Justice, to try to get this thing to trial. Now, what I did is I looked back at the origins of the case, and I got all the documents from the state of Florida.
We should just back up for a moment. I'm sure most people remember what happened here, but just give us the 30-second story of what prompted all of this by the Justice Department and so on.
Well, okay. On February 26, 2012, Trayvon Martin was shot. The Sanford, Florida police investigated for two and a half weeks, They said, we looked at all the physical evidence, 911 calls, eyewitnesses, interviewed everybody, and they decided on March 12th, this was a case of self-defense, not stand your ground, pure self-defense, it's over.
Self-defense by whom?
George Zimmerman.
And George Zimmerman was doing a sort of volunteer security?
No, he really wasn't. He was just a member of this neighborhood watch group, and he was going to Target, and he saw what he thought was a man standing around in the rain, and he was told that if you see anybody kind of doesn't look like they belong there or doing something strange, call the non-emergency number. So that's what he did, and in the film, by the way, you can see the trailer and get the DVD, the book, live stream. It's on thetrayvonhoax.com. And we go into all of that. Zimmerman is in the movie. He didn't even testify in his own trial, but he tells what really happened. But let me give you the chronology, which is really interesting. The police say it's self-defense. Then they send down Al Sharpton. They send down the DOJ to push protests.
When you say they, who do you mean?
Department of Justice sent the Community Relations Service.
But who sent Al Sharpton down?
Al Sharpton was called by the family attorney for the Crump, Benjamin Crump, for the Martin family. He brought Al Sharpton down and he said, we called up to New York City to get somebody with a track record. Well, Al Sharpton's track record was race hoaxes, incitement of violence, Freddy's Fashion Mart, Crown Heights, riots. So they brought him down for that purpose to agitate. And that's what he did. So a week after the police said this was self-defense, there's nothing to do here, Benjamin Crump, the family attorney, held a press conference, and he held up a digital recorder, and he said, "We just found Trayvon's girlfriend. She was on the phone with him the night up to the minute he was shot. She heard everything." And he plays a recorder of this girl where she says a couple of things that aren't really that intelligible. And he says, "We got all the evidence now. And arrest George Zimmerman." So the next day, Obama jumps on board. He says, "If I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon." Then LeBron James and the NBA start talking about it. And the state of Florida is pressured into appointing a special prosecutor to investigate. Now, when Benjamin Crump held this press conference, and the next day he also went on the Today Show, he said, "It's a 16-year-old girl. Her name is Diamond Eugene. She's only 16. They were in love." 2 weeks later, the police come and the prosecutors to interview Diamond Eugene. I've got the documents. They go up to Diamond Eugene's house, and they send her. The police are sent away to somewhere else, and that's when this 18-year-old Rachel Gentel appears. People remember her from the trial. Trayvon's girlfriend, she's supposedly she's 100 pounds heavier than him and a year older. People remember that she said she wrote a letter to Trayvon's mother but couldn't read it. She didn't really know what she was talking about. So what I had done is I got Trayvon's 750-page cell phone records, and I investigated the entire background of who's who, and I found out that Trayvon really did have a girlfriend named Diamond Eugene. I found Diamond Eugene, and she's in the movie. And I showed how Rachel Gentel was substituted in for this girl named Diamond, the real girlfriend, the real girl who was on the phone, in order to get Zimmerman arrested and get the case to trial.
Substituted by whom, Joel?
Several people were involved. When you watch the film, you'll see the whole kind of chronology. It's very well detailed. And what happened was Diamond Eugene did not want to come forward because she knew what really happened. The family attorney put out this narrative, this false narrative, that Trayvon was a small child who was only trying to get home to deliver candy and was attacked because of his skin color. That was the narrative he put out there for weeks.
And the hoodie.
The hoodie is the skin color thing. And Diamond would not come forward. She was heavily pressured. I could tell through the phone records that who was Trayvon's friends, Trayvon's father, his mother, the attorney, were all pressuring her, and she refused. Finally, 3 weeks later, under extreme duress, she agreed to do the phone interview. Then when she was asked to come and lie to the police, and by the way, in that phone interview, she just repeats back to Crump whatever he says. Then when they say, "Okay, now you got to talk to the police," she bailed out. She refused, and Rachel Gentel was substituted in. Now, the people that knew about it, number one, is Trayvon's mother, Sabrina Fulton. That's proven in the film, and that's very significant because she's running for Miami-Dade commissioner right now. She just got endorsed by Hillary and Cory Booker, and there's no question, I believe, that they're going to bring her out to the 2020 convention like they did in 2016 to push this race-based narrative that there's armed white men in the streets that want to shoot you, and you better vote Democrat or you might be shot by a cop or whatever it might be.
You have certainly given us plenty of food for thought, Joel Gilbert. Thank you very much for your time today. I look forward to a further visit with you in the near future to learn more about what you found and to respond to some of the other developments that we'll likely see in the days ahead. I look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.